Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT FM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm happy to welcome back to the program from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine our friend Dr. Dale Hurd, and we're going to be talking today about something that I'm really excited about because we haven't talked about it a lot on this program before, but it's of great interest to me and probably many of you as well. Birds. We're going to talk about sort of domestic birds as pets, but also about wild birds too. Lots of bird talk coming up on Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT. After this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. So happy to welcome back to the program today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, our friend Dr. Daryl Hurd. And we're going to be talking today about birds, which is wonderful because birds are amazing creatures. Everyone can agree on that. And we don't talk about birds very often on this show, which I think is kind of unfortunate. So we're going to try and make up for lost time today and have a great discussion about birds. And we can talk about birds both sort of domestic as pets and as wild creatures as well. So welcome back to the program first. Let me thank you for coming back today.
Yeah, it's great to be back, Dana. This is a topic that's dear to my heart. This is what got me interested in veterinary medicine a long time ago.
Can we explore that for a minute? So you, as many people will recognize, you are probably not originally from the United States.
That's true. I'm from Australia.
Yes.
From Perth, actually.
So everyone knows about Australia, that Australia has really amazing animals there that are distinct because they evolved in a different way away from many of the other animals that exist around the world.
Mm-hmm.
You probably have a lot of amazing birds there too.
Yeah, I mean, that's one. If you ever visit Australia, that's one of the neat things to see is you see a lot of beautiful birds, including the parrots, which are kept as cage birds. But there are many, many species, and there's species that you wouldn't necessarily see in North America. A good example being the emu. The right. Large flightless ratite.
Sure. So birds, of course, come in all different shapes and sizes. Mm-hmm. We've got birds that don't really fly. We've got birds that can fly very, very long distances. We've got birds that migrate, birds that don't migrate at all. Mm-hmm. Evolutionarily, can we talk just a little bit about how long birds have been around? I mean, some people talk about birds descending from dinosaurs, that dinosaurs were kind of something that led to birds. But I don't know a lot about this.
Yeah, I mean, the consensus is that that birds are effectively living dinosaurs and they are directly descended from dinosaurs, at least the literature that I've seen. So hundreds of millions of years in terms of their lineages. There are certainly birds that have diverged from the dinosaurs during that time period, but yes, birds are living dinosaurs.
Now, on this program, we mostly talk about mammals, but mm-hmm. birds are not mammals. And so there's some different physiology, a lot of different things in birds than in your cat or your dog.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good comment because even though there are birds that don't fly or are very reluctant to fly, all birds are derived from flying animals. And so if you're flying, there are certain constraints on your evolution. So you want to be as lightweight as possible, and then you have to be able to take in as much oxygen to support your high metabolism that is required for being able to fly. So they have a very, very efficient respiratory system. It's considered more efficient or the most efficient of any of the vertebrates, so more so than mammals.
And like, say, reptiles and some other creatures, birds don't give birth to live offspring. They have eggs.
Yes, they all lay eggs and they all incubate them in some way. Most of them, the parents, one or both, will incubate the eggs. There are some exceptions. There are some interesting birds around the world. Actually, from Australia, there's a bird called the mallee fowl that actually digs basically a big pile of compost and let's see eggs incubate in that warm sand, and there is no parental care of those animals.
So when you were becoming a veterinarian, when you had sort of made that decision for yourself, were you interested primarily in working with wild animals or with domestic animals?
With all. I like wild animals, you know, and free-living animals, but I also deal with them in the context of captivity, so zoos and people also with private pets and so forth. But as I mentioned, you know, that was what got me first interested was birds actually starting. We used to have a couple of budgies, and then I ended up getting some finches. I thought that was the neatest thing, and I used to have large planted aviaries. So
we've got birds, which as a class of animals are enormous, really. There's so many different kinds of birds. They live pretty much all over the globe, right? I mean, maybe with some of the exceptions of the very, very coldest places on the planet, you can find birds.
Yeah, I mean, but you will see birds everywhere. I mean, even both the Arctic and the Antarctic. I mean, the Antarctic, obviously, the penguins and their equivalent up north are the orcs and loons and, you know, eiders and so forth. So, yeah, they cover everywhere. Deserts, tropical rainforests. And the oceans, you know,
sure.
Albatrosses are a good example of
that. I mean, these animals can fly very far in some instances. Mm. Some hardly travel very much at all.
Yeah.
You know, I think about the animals that we see here in this community in North Central Florida, and a person could go out even in his or her own backyard, and if you've given an environment that seems hospitable enough, you could see dozens even different kinds of birds even in your own backyard in North Central Florida.
Yeah, I mean, I've been here a long time in Gainesville, and I consider myself an amateur bird watcher at best. But yeah, every year I'm surprised, actually. If you look closely and you pay attention, it's amazing the birds that do move through here. And actually, birds are moving through now as part of the migration. The eastern coast of the United States, a lot of birds come down the east coast through Florida, and then out over the Gulf through the Yucatan and down into South America to winter.
If we're going to talk about birds today, maybe we can just start here with some discussion about then wild birds. When we talk about birds that migrate versus birds that don't, what kind of makes that determination for a particular species of bird to be migratory versus non-migratory?
I mean, there are a lot of factors. I mean, if you look at some of the bird species that migrate up to the northern climes to breed in the summer. The advantage of doing that, even though you've got a very short summer season, and I'm thinking of some of the shorebirds and other things that are up north, is that you also have long daylight hours, and you often have a lot of insects and so forth. And so you can breed there and then, you know, raise your young and then move back out before the winter sets in. And there are some birds that actually take full advantage of it and go from both southern and northern hemispheres. So a good example of that, really extreme example of a migratory bird, are the Arctic terns, which go from north, you know, northern climes all the way down to the southern climes and back.
It requires, though, a tremendous amount of energy and probably the better part of any of these individual animals' lives.
Yes, and this becomes a big issue with certain species, because certain habitats are very, very important as food sources before the migration, where they build up fat stores and so forth, and then also in the intervening period. So not only do these, in terms of protection, they need to be able to have these habitats that allow them to be able to migrate and have them enough food to provide the energy.
Sure, and food is something that is critical to the survival of any individual on any long trip. And when you've got birds that are traveling along, are they finding food along the way at every stage that meets their dietary needs? Because what you might find somewhere far, far north is going to be different than what you might find sort of towards the tropics. And if they're going even further than that, you know, are they finding enough on the way to really satisfy them, or do they make relatively few stops for food?
A lot of species make relatively few stops, you know, although sometimes you'll see, you know, birds that will hang out in an area like, you know, during the springtime, we'll get the robins coming through Gainesville. They don't breed here. but I'll sometimes watch. You can see them almost waiting for the weather to change, and they're hanging out and they're feeding in our area. And then they'll move further north depending on what the weather is and sort of incrementally get their way up. And when it gets just to the right time, they may actually make a big, you know, migration and go get back to where they need to be.
So I'm glad you mentioned the robins. These are the lovely birds. They're not the same as like a European robin. These are different, the kind of North American robins that we're talking about.
Yeah, different groups of animals. It's interesting because European colonists, the same issue happened in Australia, is that you move to North America and you see something that looks like a bird that you know from Europe, and you'll name it a robin. So there are Australian robins, there are North American robins, there are European robins, and they're not necessarily related at all.
So the robins, though, that we know and we love from the early springtime here in Gainesville, these are the ones that have sort of the rusty kind of reddish sort of breast that they have. And you'll sometimes find them in pretty big groups. You might look out your window and just all along the grass, they'll just be covered in these robins.
Yeah, and this is also characteristic of migrating birds, is they clump together, so for protection. And then also, in some ways, some of the younger birds need to know the migratory routes. They learn them off the parents.
So they will reproduce these routes later on in their lives, long after they've separated from their parents.
Yeah, definitely.
It's remarkable, because anyone who has thought at all about migration or read even a little bit about it, it's something that boggles the mind. I mean, you and I are, of course, sentient creatures, and we can reason and we can say, oh, well, we're going to be moving from Australia to Florida. we will follow a career path that will take us across the globe to move here. Birds sort of function probably not quite the same way. Can you talk any about what it is that motivates these animals to do that? It's something inside them that compels them to do it.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, but this is not my true expertise. But, you know, and there are many, at least my, you know, take on the literature, there are many different factors that move animals. Obviously, food, and then timing can be related to things such as photo period and temperature, et cetera. And this is where the problem with climate change is coming in, is where you're actually seeing animals either returning early to the breeding areas or leaving late because the weather is better, or having to move further north to get the right temperature, right environment, and then also changes in vegetation and then food sources. And that's where changing climate can be problematic for these birds, because if they don't time it right, the food won't be there, or the conditions are not going to be appropriate, or they get caught, you know, with inappropriate weather trying to come back out again. So
I want to come back around to some of these topics, but I think my director Richard is telling me that we can go to the phones and talk to Bill, I believe. Bill, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about the island off of Cedar Key. I believe it's Snake Island. They had a huge bird population there, and all of a sudden it was gone. And I'm just wondering if there's any knowledge about what happened to them, or are they going to become, of course, I don't know if they're coming back or not.
That's a great question. Go back to your radio, Bill, and we're gonna discuss this, because I think I sort of know kind of what you're getting at. You know, birds are susceptible, particularly in places in which they are suddenly kind of exposed to predators they maybe weren't used to, right?
That is one issue, but sort of peripherally, I know the story. This is actually Seahorse Key, which is run by the University of Florida. It's a research island. They had a large breeding rookery of pelicans and some of the other water birds for many years, and then suddenly there was a cessation of the breeding, and no one knows why. And they suspect they probably moved on. People were arguing it was from the recent oil spill, the Gulf oil spill, or, you know, maybe some other reasons. Because they are fish-eating birds for the most part, you know, changes in fish supplies or food supplies can alter it. And then we sometimes will only see like these rookeries for maybe a period of 50 years, but over hundreds of years, the birds don't necessarily have to come back to that same area. They may have just moved to another area which is better for them in terms of food, protection of their young, et cetera.
So when we talk about the food supplies that birds enjoy and different birds eat different things, we think about it's probably important to think about how, of course, there's an interconnectedness between birds and their environment from which they derive their food. And birds that are, let's say, seabirds in this instance, could be particularly susceptible to the effects of any kind of ecological disaster, because though any individual bird might not have necessarily been physically touched by the oil and been injured by that, the environment changes because it's less hospitable to their food supplies.
Yeah, I mean, it may begin even at the very lower level, you know, with invertebrates and they're moving up through the food chain. If you lose one part of that food chain or one of the links, then you may end up disrupting the whole ecosystem, and then with quite marked changes in food accessibility for these animals.
But in the scheme of things, birds are important creatures in the animal kingdom, right? That is to say that, you know, birds interact with the world, and their absence or their moving around or their decreased numbers in certain areas could potentially have an environmental impact that we might not necessarily consciously think of as just sort of average people.
Yeah, I mean, there's different. I mean, it's really hard sometimes to predict what the changes would be without birds being around. But they serve many functions. I mean, a good example, even just simple things like seed dispersal. They eat fruits.
Exactly.
The seeds are dispersed and at a distance because they do fly. So that's a good way of magnifying or spreading plants. And I know actually that some people have used that as a technique for replanting an area. Is actually put up a wire so that birds perch on them and actually drop seedlings with feces. That's a nice – or the seeds, so that it's a nice way for them to germinate and so forth.
It's sort of like you'll have heard of about this, of course, is people can sometimes forget the importance of some things that we take for granted. For instance, bees, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like honeybees do an amazing thing. And without honeybees, our lives would be really different, though we might not think about them. And we might not think a lot about some of the birds that we don't get to interact with because they're not pets, but they're serving a very important function.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interrelationships, that we don't perceive. And that's one of the amazing things, as I mentioned, is just about every month there's something new that we go, wow. You know, that was an amazing, piece of information. And again, for an example, you use the bees as pollinators. Well, there are also many bird species that serve a similar function. And some of the plants and the flowering plants are actually not bee pollinated, but birds and also bats. You know, we've had a discussion about bats previously as well. They're all important for fertilizing plants. And a good example is the hummingbird in our area. In Australia, there are a group of birds called honey eaters, which sort of have a similar niche. As the name would suggest, they take honey or nectar out of flowers, and in the same process, they pollinate those flowers.
As creatures, birds are astonishing to me in their variety and their adaptations that make them very good at a particular thing. Now, you mentioned the hummingbirds and the honey eaters, and I'm thinking too about birds that have developed beaks, which are perfectly suited to the foods that they eat. And this, of course, probably makes perfect sense in an evolutionary way. But just as a layperson to have read about some of this, it's really a wonder to behold how specialized some of these animals have gotten.
Yeah, I mean, and if you look at the anatomy and more specifically, it really is amazing. You know, if you look at the woodpeckers, which are in our local area, their tongues are so phenomenally long. They're actually longer than the beak and head combined. And there's a special adaptation where the tongue actually extends all the way around to the back of the head, but allows them to obviously pick out insects from a deep hole that they've been able to pound away at.
Mm-hmm. So. And they're very industrious, and yeah. we see them around here, and you got to have a lot of respect mm-hmm. for these creatures that just go out there and they just go for it. Sort of the birds that we see around here in North Central Florida can be divided maybe between a couple different categories. We've got the sort of birds that you might see around your yard, the sort of songbirds, the kind of cardinals and blue jays and mockingbirds and chickadees and titmice and those sorts of things. And they're lovely to look at, and they'll come to your feeder even. We've got lots of mourning doves and such like that, right? But we also in North Central Florida have some raptors, some birds of prey. Can we talk a little bit about the different categories of birds that we see around here?
Yeah, I mean, like in terms of raptors, we're very lucky. And even though there was a decline, remember, in the bald eagles from DDT, is that even with the decline, you know, Florida and Gainesville and the Latcher and the surrounding areas always kept a pretty good population of bald eagles, and they're still rebounding. So they're very, very common around here. I mean, you've got the other fish eater, the ospreys you'll see. To us, we take in injured wildlife. So the most common raptor that we would see are actually the red-shouldered hawks. It's interesting because I've been here for a number of years. We used to see more red-tailed hawks, and we still see occasional red-tailed hawks, and we actually see more of them as they migrate. So some of these raptors do migrate through. So red-tailed hawks, occasionally what will happen now as birds fall out of the migration, usually young birds, we'll see some of those. In terms of the owls, the most common used to be we used to see great horned owls, and now we see barred owls more commonly. We don't see screech owls very much at all. The other owl species in Florida, the barn owl, is further south. They like open fields, and then, of course, the burrowing owls, but the environment up here is not really conducive to the burrowing owls.
I'm thinking about the different owls that we have and how I have seen them many times in my neighborhood. I've heard them more often perhaps than I've seen them, though I've seen them as well. And sometimes you might hear their very distinctive sort of hoot that they give at night. And you hear them communicating back and forth. And I don't know exactly what their sort of pairing behavior is, but I assume that they are communicating with other individuals.
Yeah, they're both for, you know, finding a mate, but also defining their territories as well. So there's a lot of communication, and also obviously their offspring too would also be looking for them as well.
Now, are there some owls that hunt together sort of in a team? Do owls do that?
You know, I'm not I can't think offhand where there's an example of that. There are certainly diurnal raptors. There's some examples out west. There's a bird called the Harris hawk that hunts as a group, and then one of my favorite birds in Florida is the swallow-tailed hawk. You see those, they come in the spring and they're all gone by September. They actually migrate in winter down in Brazil. Those birds, the offspring from previous years, actually help raise the next generation, and so you'll see a group of those. Whether you could say that's communal hunting or not, but they certainly will share food amongst themselves.
When we talk about some of the raptors and the ones that you mentioned too, they're common enough that if you kind of know what to look for or what to listen for often, you can see them. And what I mean by listen for is I will sometimes hear blue jays or mockingbirds kind of having a fit.
Yeah.
And then it occurs to me they're upset about the presence of something around, and it's sometimes one of these maybe red-shouldered hawks.
Yeah, the interesting thing, actually, the blue jay does a really good imitation of a red-shouldered hawk. But one of the defense mechanisms is what's called mobbing, and the smaller birds, when they identify a raptor or a potential predator, they go after it rather than, you know, flee from it. And I remember sitting at a light the other day, and I saw a red-tailed hawk floating above me. And then this mockingbird just came out of nowhere. It was like, you know, the old days in World War II with the Spitfires going up to, you know, take out a bomber or what have you. And it just – there was no hesitation.
None.
Little bird going towards the predator.
It's a kind of bravery that astonished me the first time I saw it. It was over at the Plaza of the Americas, and there was a hawk just kind of in one of the magnolia trees there.
Mm-hmm.
The mockingbirds did not like the presence of this, and I watched as mockingbirds would bodily, you know, come into contact with this hawk, and the hawk seemed to just tolerate it in a bemused kind of way. When I thought to myself, well, he probably could make short work of one of these mockingbirds if he wanted to.
Yeah, and as long as they can see them, though, because a lot of these are ambush predators. And so if you see them and you can identify the predator, it's very hard for them to sneak up on anything. And so then they just annoy them to get them out of the area. But that's also an important thing is that, you know, during the daytime, if you see owls and you bring attention to them, you know, that's one of the problems is they will also be mobbed by diurnal birds. And that can be very annoying or distressing to them, particularly if they get some of the bigger birds like crows and ravens will definitely go after after these birds, and that can be a significant you know, annoyance.
There's so much wonderful stuff even happening just around us. Now, with the birds like the eagles and the hawks, what is their primary prey around here? Small rodents, things like that?
Yeah, whatever they can catch. I mean, the bald eagles are pretty indiscriminate, and they actually will take, you know, roadkill if they can scavenge it or what have you. So they got a wide range of animals that they will take. The red shoulders, once again, it's a little bit smaller prey. And this is interesting thing with raptors is that a number of raptor species, the males are a lot smaller than the females. And the argument, the reason for that is that they can be paired together, but they feed on different, you know, prey items and different food requirements or what have you.
Yes. So that's so wonderful. There's so much more that we can talk about as far as birds go. And we're going to take a short break here on Animal Airwaves Live. We'll be back with more of Daryl Hurd coming up right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Daryl Hurd from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, and we're talking about birds. And we spent a little bit of time at the beginning of the show talking about more wild birds, and it's probably a good time to transition to a topic of interest to many people, and that is birds that are sort of kept as pets. And birds have been kept as pets forever.
Yeah, I mean, thousands of years. I mean, there's some evidence of, you know, things like the Alexandrine parrot, you know, kept in the, you know, the time of Alexander the Great and so forth. So there's good evidence that there have been many, many thousands of years. And even in the Americas, I mean, the scarlet macaws were very popular pets, or if you could say that, in, you know, with the Native Americans, with the Incas and with the Aztecs.
So these days, what are some of the more common birds kept as pets?
We mostly see little parrots, although people will keep finches and canaries. And the parrots, the most common would be obviously the classic Australian budgerigar, or some people call it parakeet, but that just refers to a diminutive small parrot. Cockatiels are very, very popular as well. And another one from South America is the monk parrot or Quaker parrot is very popular.
Now, what do you think makes a particular bird suitable for keeping as a pet versus not suitable for keeping as a pet at all?
You know, over the years, I've really come to realize there's many, particularly parrot species that really shouldn't or don't make good pets, or they really only should be for people who are specialized with certain animal groups. If you were starting out with a bird, you know, or you wanted a parrot, then as I've already talked about, I think the budgerigar is a good starting point. Maybe if you want something a little bit bigger, a cockatiel or a Quaker or monk parrot. Those have been domesticated for quite a while. There are lots of pretty colors, and they're well adapted to captivity. But going into a pet store and looking and seeing a beautiful big macaw is the wrong way to start.
Yeah. So what advice would you give to folks who are thinking about having a pet, a bird as a pet? What kind of needs do birds have, and how might a person actually meet those needs as best as possible?
You know, the preferable thing I would want, firstly, is to look at, you know, what do you want in terms of, do you want the bird to interact with you? Or what I used to enjoy is what I call the aquarium effect. So I had planted aviaries with finches and so forth. So decide, you know, what sort of interaction you might want to have with the birds. And then I like to provide. I mean, these birds naturally fly. So ideally, I would want to have an environment where they could fly. And that becomes problematic when you start talking about big birds. A macaw is not designed to sit on a cage and not fly. And I used to have many parrots many years ago, and I had large parrots and I had small cages, you know, for them. And I would not get a big parrot now without having an aviary that I could allow them to fly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's really, really important. And the design of the caging is really, really important. But go on, sorry.
Well, I was going to say that birds, too, are I think a really unfair epithet is to call someone a bird brain, because birds really are actually quite smart. And you should probably, if you have a pet bird, give it an environment in which it can feel kind of engaged, in which it can be stimulated.
Yeah, I mean that is very, very important. And you see this with some of the behavioral issues that we see with birds, particularly feather picking would be a good example of that. But, you know, you take a parrot that's well recognized to be very, very intelligent, African gray parrot, you know, and putting them into a small cage with minimal stimulation during the day is going to lead to, you know, behavioral issues. So,
is there a way that people who want birds as pets can have some confidence that these birds were not captured in an unethical way or mistreated or are not, you know, I'd hate to think that, you know, someone might have as a pet something that was caught out in the wild.
Well, the good thing now is that there is no importation of parrots or other birds into North America unless it's for, say, a zoological facility or a legitimate zoological facility or for research. And this was because of, yes, in the 80s when I first came to this country, there were many, many parrots that were being imported, and that was gradually shut down through the urging of some of the animal rights groups legitimately, and actually stopping airliners, you know, airline companies flying in these birds. But now there is a total moratorium on importation of parrots. So any parrots that you see in North America are either from that period, because some of them are old enough to have been from that period, or they've been bred in captivity. And the way to want it to ensure that you've got, you know, an animal that's been looked after is obviously visit the facilities, you know, where they came from, if possible,
mm-hmm.
or see how they're cared for in the pet store that you get them from.
So you pick a bird that is going to be one that you can really take adequate care of, that you've got enough space to give it sufficient room to kind of feel happy in its environment.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to choose a bird that you can give enough time to, assuming it's a bird that kind of thrives on an interaction and stimulation.
Yeah, and this is a big issue, and it's become a recognized issue when birds, you know, as I mentioned, parrots were being imported in large numbers in the 80s. And then people started breeding these parrots, and then to tame the animals, so that's what the idea was, they were hand-raising the parrots. Unfortunately, now we recognize that is not the ideal bird, because they recognize people as a bird, and they don't look at other birds as, you know, as their own kind. And so a particular group that you have to worry about is cockatoos. There are a lot of hand-raised cockatoos with behavioral issues, and if you select them as a pet and they're bonded strongly to you, if you look at them, their behavior in the wild is that these birds, the pair bond is very, very tight for many, many years, and they never leave each other. You know, they're either sticking together, and if they do leave each other, they scream. And so then you've got two behaviors. You can't leave the parrot at home when you go to work, or the cockatoo. And then when you do, you end up with these screaming behavior. And then I already mentioned feather picking is another big issue. And on top of that, it's not like a dog or a cat where they have a limited lifespan. These birds can live, and I've seen cockatoos 80 or 90 years of age. And so there are many, many abandoned birds or parrots because of these, you know, behaviors that don't make them good pets. People didn't recognize them.
Right. So one should not just be capricious about selecting for a pet a bird like a cockatoo, because let's say you're a 40-year-old guy and you go to get this animal, it's almost certainly going to outlive you.
Yes, and then you got to find some mechanism of passing the animal on to another good home, if that's possible.
Right, because this animal has developed a bond with you, and there's really no substitute for you, right? You
yeah.
are this bird's, like, you're this bird's pal. I mean,
yeah.
you guys are connected.
Mm-hmm.
So if maybe that's not a really great choice, maybe some other kinds of birds could be pets that would be a little bit more suitable. So we've talked about giving them some space and giving them the kinds of things that they might need. What about feeding? Adequate, you know, food
yeah,
for these
so that's,
animals?
Yeah, so that's the other critical issue. You know, when we're dealing with parrots, you go to the pet store, and traditionally what these animals would be fed would be just be the dry seeds. And dry seeds are not what the animals would normally be feeding in the wild. They'd be eating green seeds and a variety of other plant materials. But the dry seeds, there's a number of issues. Firstly, they're deficient in a number of vitamins and micronutrients, and a big one is vitamin A. And vitamin A is really important for normal feathering, beak, toenails, and then skin and eyes, et cetera. And so you see issues related to vitamin A deficiency. And then also seed is very high in fat and protein. So obesity is really, really a common problem in some of the parrot species that we deal with. And then following on from that, interestingly enough, a lot of parrots, particularly as they get older, will develop similar cardiovascular issues with humans because of the diet. So atherosclerosis and heart disease, we're seeing more and more of these birds. Particularly, I mentioned a lot of parrots came in the 80s, and now we're seeing the birds that are 30 or 40 years of age and starting to show the effects of poor nutrition chronically, and then also older changes.
Now, as a veterinarian in the clinical setting, when you see birds, are problems with birds harder to treat than, say, a problem with a dog or a cat?
I think a lot of the issues are related to recognizing the disease in the birds. Birds, even though we have them, they've been in captivity. You know, a lot of the species are still really wild. And in the wild, you don't want to show clinical signs of illness. So unless you're really, really sick, you're not going to you pretend that you're all okay, so you're not the one who gets picked off by the hawk. And consequently, we will see birds that the owner goes, it was fine yesterday, but, you know, is really, really sick today. And then you look at them and you realize the body condition, this animal has been ill for some period of time. But that's not the fault necessarily of the owner. It's the recognition of the very subtle signs of clinical disease in these animals. So that's one big issue with these animals is a little bit different.
Let's go back to the phones and talk to one of our guests from Crystal River. Hello, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Hi, my name is Michelle, and we are the proud owners for 16 years of an orange wing Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
We've had her since she was 8 weeks old, and we're assuming she's very happy. She's a great bird. But I don't know really the protocol I'm supposed to be following, because it's not like a dog or a cat that needs, yearly shots. So how do I know I'm doing the right thing? I've done some research.
Yeah, such a great question. Thank you for calling. Let's talk about this, Dr. Hurt.
Yeah, I mean, these are actually my favorite parrot species too, the orange wings, although they're very common when they were being imported, but they're a really nice, sweet bird. The first thing is looking at the diet. I was starting to discuss the issue about whole seeds being not the appropriate diet, or sunflower seeds. There are good pelleted, quality pelleted diets that are designed for feeding parrots. The problem that comes about is if you try to transition them over, if they're used to eating a seed diet, it can take several years to do that. Usually what I hear is, we tried it for a week and it didn't work. But you need to work at this over a period of time. And it's well worth it to, in the context of the overall long lifespan of these animals, to spend 6 months or 12 months transitioning I would emphasize, though, that you cannot starve a bird to take a palleted diet. You cannot just empty the food bowl out and then put in the pellets. You'll end up with a dead bird, unfortunately. So diet is really important. And then as the bird gets older, just as we do, having regular visits to your veterinarian, maybe annually, if only to do a physical examination and pick up on some, you know, problems that may be arising. If you are very concerned, sometimes we'll do blood work just to check to see how their different body organs are functioning and so forth. One of the issues with the anatomy with birds, unlike dogs or cats, is they're a little bit more difficult to evaluate just from a physical examination. And so we recommend if we had a sick bird, we usually will do blood work and whole body radiographs if necessary as they get older. I wouldn't necessarily recommend that continuously. But good diet and regular checkups with your veterinarian. And if you're concerned about getting an avian veterinarian, we certainly see birds here at the University of Florida, but you can go, there's an Association of Avian Veterinarians, a website, and they have a list of avian veterinarians in your local area.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
I really appreciate it. I was feeling a little guilty at first, but she's just a phenomenal pet. So
yeah, they're great. They're great birds.
Thank you very much for the call, Michelle. I really, really appreciate it. Dr. Hurd, you know, something that Michelle hinted at in her call was, you know, that she feels like her bird is really happy. Can we know, based on a bird's sort of appearance, whether or not we're meeting all of this bird's demands or needs, really, as a pet?
I think it's just what you would assume for any pet. I mean, it's looking at just how they look and their activity level and what they do during the day. I mean, if they're just sitting there on the perch not doing anything or even developing some of these abnormal behaviors that we mentioned, such as feather picking or, you know, repetitive movements or calling or screaming, then we would have issues. But otherwise, if they interact with you, and they actually will come to you. I mean, that's one thing, is not grabbing them out of a cage. But if they willingly will come out of a cage and approach you, that would be suggestive that that's a positive thing for them. So,
are there infectious diseases that pet owners maybe should worry about with birds?
Yeah, there's a lot of disease issues. Not that I want to turn you off owning a bird, but one disease that's particularly important is a disease called chlamydia. It's not the same. It's a chlamydia citici, or another name is chlamydiophila. They keep changing the taxonomy. That's a really important disease. It's been called parrot fever in the past, but it's a organism. It's type of bacteria that affects a lot of range of different birds. Most importantly, though, it can also affect humans. And so clinical signs in people are more of a sort of a flu-like disease going through to full-blown pneumonia. And that was the reason why there was a ban from the early 1930s to the 1970s on keeping or importing parrots into the United States because of this parrot fever associated with ownership. And then subsequently we had antibiotics to treat this, and then they reopened the parrot trade. But that is a really important disease. And then there are some viral diseases that we see. The number one infectious disease of parrots in North America is what we used to call a syndrome, proventricular dilatation syndrome. It has actually now been shown to be a virus. It's a Borna virus. Unfortunately, we don't have a treatment at the moment. We don't have a vaccine, although I know there's a research group out in Texas that is working on a vaccine, and some other groups also around the country are working on a vaccine, and that would be the way to prevent that. But at the moment, we don't recommend vaccination for pet birds.
Would these birds contract these infections from other birds or from the environment?
From other birds. And the big issue now, we were looking at, you know, we're importing a lot of parrots in the 1980s, different part of the world, you know, lots of different diseases, and then we're mixing them all together, or we're hand raising the birds together. And that's the ideal environment to mix viruses, and particularly throwing viruses into birds which have not developed the normal immunity to those particular viruses. So proventricular dilatation syndrome, interestingly enough, began as a disease syndrome called the macaw wasting syndrome. So that would suggest that it was a South American virus. But now it can be present in any parrot species, from a budgie to a macaw. And there's a variety of different clinical presentations for that.
in the short amount of time that we have left, about 2 minutes, might you offer any sort of advice to folks just about birds in general, be they wild birds? You know, obviously I would probably think the best advice for wild animals is just kind of leave them be and let them be wild animals. I mean, aside from, you know, maybe having a bird feeder outside so, you know, the cardinals and whatnot might enjoy that. But advice for people who have pets as well.
I mean, for the outdoor birds, I think firstly, get to know your birds. And I would, if you're really interested in birds, I would highly recommend joining the local chapter of the Audubon Society. And then they have people that have professional almost bird watchers and then birding tours and so forth. Adapting your backyard for native birds, and there's the Native Plant Society and so forth, and even the butterfly group, that's crossover. The environment that's good for butterflies is often good for a number of our small birds that we have around. And then in terms of captive birds, as we're already gone over, just be careful in your selection. Don't impulse buy. Is to research. Do you want a bird? Do you want the commitment? And then what type of bird when you come to it? And then look at the appropriate type of husbandry to maximize the health and long-term care. And then also check with your veterinarian. See your veterinarian regularly.
Such sound advice. Birds are amazing and wonderful creatures, and I'm glad we finally got the chance to talk about it. And I hope we'll get to have many more conversations about birds coming up in the future. Thank you so much, Gerhard, for coming back to the program.
It's my pleasure, and I'd love to talk about birds again in the future.
Right.
Thank you.
I want to say thanks to Richard Drake for directing the show, Sarah Carey and her staff at the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Dana Hill. Hope you'll join me again next time for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.